Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
When I am asked, what department are you in? And I'm asked this a million times. I say, I teach American literature. and I do not answer the question because I don't want people to say, oh, Milton, you know, Chaucer, Shakespeare. No, those aren't my writers. So I say I teach American literature.
Nobody should be able to call themselves an American literary specialist who does not read three or four languages at least and read them with comfort. Then American literature would be what it truly is, and that is a comparativist discipline.
There are few attempts, based on the fiction I get, to write Faulkner anymore. I think there still were, probably up through the 1960s, mm-hmm. but one doesn't find that much now.
Rethinking American Literature, two conversations this week on Soundings. First, a discussion with Everett Emerson and Annette Kolodny. Everett Emerson teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Annette Kolodny is Dean of Humanities at the University of Arizona. Our topic is American Literature in the 1980s. Following that, a conversation with Fred Hobson, until recently co-editor of the Southern Review, now a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We'll talk about contemporary Southern American writing. According to Annette Kolodny and Everett Emerson, the study of American literature over the last 25 years has directed itself to previously neglected themes, such as race, class, and gender. Here is Annette Kolodny.
When you re-examine the canon of writers with which we are familiar and you ask what has been silenced in this text, you begin to understand that issues of gender, issues of race, issues of class are perhaps embedded in the text, covertly, if not overtly, discussed. Mm-hmm. That we need to be asking questions not only of we need to be asking questions about what we have omitted, and we need to be asking questions about what we have not omitted but haven't been reading accurately enough. Mm-hmm. The fact is that the new scholarship is probably the most important scholarship that's ever been done on literary history, and probably the most important criticism that's ever been done on the American literature canon. Let me suggest that it was not only a fact of discrimination, but it was a fact of ignorance. Mm-hmm. In other words, nowadays, the American literary professor who can teach Melville but not teach Charlotte Perkins Gilman ought to be accused of professional malpractice. Mm-hmm. To leave out the quality of writers that had in fact been left out until the last 15 years was reprehensible, and it betrayed the honesty, it betrayed the integrity of the wholeness of our literary cultural inheritance.
Everett Emerson, how did these changes occur? In the academy, it's a truism that things don't happen overnight, that it takes a long time for changes like the ones that Annette has been describing to take
well,
place.
Well, part of what happened was the result of the whole movement that's been going on in our society towards a greater recognition of the importance of women and minority groups. And I think that that has been a part of it. But another consideration is the fact that my women students always were among the brightest, oftentimes the very best. But society suggested that they ought to limit their aspirations.
Uh-huh. Literature for them was a bit of a pastime.
Yes, and it was suggested, you don't really want to go on for a PhD. Uh-huh. You know, maybe you will be unmarriageable if you do that. And it was a serious problem. But I want to respond to something that Annette said that is so compelling to me that I think I just have to say it. I taught at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, the great literary figure of the town of Amherst is Emily Dickinson. We had two courses in 19th century American literature that students could choose from. One was earlier 19th century and one was later 19th century. Emily Dickinson was taught in neither course in Amherst, Massachusetts.
On her home campus?
Because it was thought, well, you could include her in the other course, so we won't bother. Now, the fact of the matter is, initially, it is a challenge to teach Dickinson. Her poetry is difficult. She's a complex person. But that's what we're supposed to be up to. We're supposed to be up to the task of dealing with complicated writers who need attention, who need explaining, who need understanding. I don't feel the great need to teach Hemingway. You couldn't go to read Hemingway. But Emily Dickinson needs our help. Mm-hmm. By the time, I have to say, by the time I left the University of Massachusetts, we were spending a lot of time with Dickinson, and everyone was gratified at the experience.
Let's talk some specifics, Annette Kolodny, Everett Emerson. Let's say that I come into one of your undergraduate American literature classes, and I want to look at Hawthorne or Poe or Melville or Whitman or Emerson, all white males. What are you going to present to me by way of, what, an addition, an enrichment, a modification in my approach to these figures who, what, this is what my mom and dad told me constitute the biggies in American writing.
Well, I'll give you a little sample just because of one of the people you mentioned, Hawthorne. Mm-hmm. At the moment, I have a woman working with me on a dissertation on Sophia Hawthorne, mm-hmm. who was an exceptionally brilliant woman.
Mm-hmm. And this is Nathaniel's wife.
Nathaniel's wife,
right.
Who was... one of the famous Peabody Sisters of Salem, part of an important body of American intellectuals at the time. And it turns out that some of Hawthorne's stories borrow, in part, from his wife's journals. That's a fact a student of mine just came up with. Well, it's about time we learned that sort of thing. It's about time we realized what an important role this woman had. Now, she was not only supportive. Nathaniel always said she saved him. Uh-huh. He was a difficult person who had a complicated psychological life, and she gave him some sense of stability and all of that. But she also helped him as a writer, and she was a writer herself.
Well, isn't it? Do I have it right that one of his biographers said that pretty much dismissed Sophia? Said, well, he had a happy marriage. And that was it. We didn't really learn it.
Well, up until the 1950s, the mythology was that all of our male writers had happy marriages and that their wives had no talent, except perhaps in the kitchen or the bed. But let me give you an example of how a course might change quite radically. I teach my students Emerson. I would certainly not take Emerson out of the standard curriculum. But when we ask ourselves, who in the 19th century really fit Emerson's vision of the characteristic American, it is in fact Frederick Douglass. And Frederick Douglass's sequential autobiographies are an attempt of a black male to reconstruct himself in tune with an Emersonian ideology of typicality and Americanness.
Now, let me stop you.
I don't want to stop.
Did Emerson say this, or do we read this back into what Emerson said?
All you have to do is read Emerson's essays and say to yourself, who in Emerson's milieu in any way fit Emerson's notion of what the common American should be, mm-hmm. who the ideal poet was, who the typical American should be. And it's Douglass. And Douglass is a highly educated reader who quite well understands what it is he's doing, and he's writing very much in an Emersonian vein. And what you begin to see then in the 19th century is the essential dialogue about what constitutes a viable American identity, and it is not a white dialogue. Mm-hmm. It is a dialogue between races. But there's also a gender dialogue. We teach Thoreau, or at least we used to teach Thoreau, as a representative of the radical impulse in 19th century New England. Thoreau is not a representative of the radical impulse, so he spent a night in jail. This is hardly somebody who really makes a very profound analysis of the structural problems of industrializing corporate capitalism. Who does that? Margaret Fuller. Mm-hmm. To be sure, it's Margaret Fuller's writings from Italy that make that analysis, but it takes Margaret Fuller the opportunity to get out of Concord, to get out of the shadow of Emerson and Thoreau and Hawthorne, and go to Europe before she's able to really understand what the political implications of a certain kind of industrializing and economic structure are. The real impulse towards radicalism in the 19th century is not Thoreau, it's Fuller, who starts out by making a gender analysis in Woman of the 19th Century, mm-hmm. and when she goes to Italy, begins to make much larger and much more profound political analyses. And then if you really want to say who is making the most important kinds of changes about structural change in the 19th century, right. and who had any influence, it wasn't Emerson, it wasn't Thoreau. They were read by a very narrow audience. It was someone like Sojourner Truth, the great rhetorician of historical and public change in the 19th century, is an unprepossessing 6'1" tall black woman in her late 70s and early 80s who mesmerizes audience and challenges them to understand not only the way the society works in terms of gender relations, but also the way in which it works in terms of class relations.
All right,
that's the truth of our 19th century history, and until 15 years ago, our students didn't know that.
All right, now Annette Kolodny has just made an impassioned plea here for the presence in our American literary inheritance of Sojourner Truth, for example, instead of Henry David Thoreau.
I didn't say instead of, but certainly side by side
with. In addition to, now let me challenge you a little bit. Do we look at writers like Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth on the basis of the quality of what they did?
You bet.
On their contribution to what we call the richness of our literary and intellectual tradition, or do we look at them now in terms of these categories that we have established as important in reinterpreting our past? Do I have a mutually exclusive
on the contrary,
thing going on there?
The reason we read Emerson and Thoreau was because we had put them into categories with which we felt comfortable. The reason we didn't read Fuller and Douglass and we must understand that Sojourner Truth was not able to write, so we do not have her writings. What we have is recordings by others of five of her speeches.
And we should take this documentation seriously.
Yes, we have to take it seriously. And the evidence, the textual evidence, suggests that those who wrote down her speeches, whether they attempted to incorporate the accents and the dialect, nonetheless, got so much of her rhythms and her patterns of phrasing consistent that it's pretty clear that all five of those speeches are fairly accurately rendered. But my point here is, we established categories of excellence which were based on and fit writers like Emerson, Thoreau, and Hawthorne, which made it impossible for us to read other kinds of excellences. Our categories were in effect blinders. Now, if you dispose of the categories and read the texts, there is no question that Frederick Douglass is in part as compelling and passionate a writer as Hawthorne. He is in many ways a more interesting essayist than Emerson.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put Emerson side by side with Douglass for the most undergraduates nowadays, they will find Frederick Douglass far more available to them and speaking to them with a much more powerful voice than Emerson.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Everett Emerson and Annette Kolodny. Everett, how are we going to make room for all these people? You two are professors of American literature. You have, what, 14, 15, 16 weeks. You have all of these choices that you have to make. Again, Annette has been making this passionate plea for the inclusion of writers that we have neglected and overlooked. How are you going to do this?
Well, in the first place, it seems to me we always were mistaken when we supposed that somehow we were going to do American literature in a given period of time, as though you've had the benefit of this course, then you didn't need to read anything else.
And speaking of neat categories.
I remember seeing some of my old-time students who would have their textbooks on their shelves as though that was their lifetime literary experience. And we've got to stimulate people so that they will want to read on their own. And they will read on their own that which speaks to them, that which relates to their own issues.
Now, wait, are we putting the students in charge?
No.
We got this smorgasbord thing going
here? No. What I'm trying to say is that education is supposed to be the opening of doors.
Mm-hmm.
I never supposed that when one is educated, that meant somehow nothing more is to happen. It meant that now things can happen.
Right.
Things can begin to happen because one has been liberated. And my students who discover writers that speak to them are going to read them and read them for a long time.
I I think Everett has made the most important statement, because what he has said is that a viable education, an excellent education, is an education that empowers students. You are not going to teach students in 4 years everything they need to know for life. What you're going to teach them is the ability to keep learning. And what Everett is suggesting is we teach them such a wide variety of texts that they can continue for the rest of their lives to read an even greater variety.
Annette Kolodny is Dean of Humanities at the University of Arizona. Everett Emerson teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Rethinking American Literature continues with a discussion featuring Fred Hobson. Prior to his recent appointment at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Fred Hobson taught at Louisiana State University and served as co-editor of the Southern Review. Here is Fred Hobson.
Certainly, Southern literature has changed as the South has changed, and I think what has happened in the last 5 or 10 years is a new confidence in Southern literature. I think for a time in the period between, say, the late 60s and the mid 70s, there was real doubt about where Southern literature was going, Southern fiction in particular. In a way, what would happen to Southern literature when the South ceases being as distinctive as it had been? The idea of the Sun Belt. The assumption, of course, is that the South in the past had been the failed, tragic, defeated, poor section of America, and much of American literature, or much of Southern literature, Faulkner in particular, had begun with this assumption, basically. What happens then in a South that is suddenly optimistic, successful, not altogether wealthy, but at least with the promise and the feeling of becoming wealthy soon?
It changes its literature.
Yes, it does. And I think it seemed to take Southern writers a while to adapt to the changing South. I think that adaptation began, though, in the mid-70s, and now writers are no longer under the shadow of Faulkner in the way I think they still were through the early 70s.
Are there ways, Fred Hobson, that we can figure out of amongst the Southern writers who are active today, the people that we're going to be reading in 100 years or so, or do we always have to wait until they're dead and buried to figure out who's great and who's not great and all of that?
In a sense, I think it's tougher now than it was probably 30 or 40 years ago. I think it was pretty obvious when William Styron started to write in the late 40s that Styron was going to be one of the notable Southern writers, one of the notable American writers of his time. The same can't be said, though, for Faulkner. If you go back and look at reviews of Faulkner in the 30s, Faulkner's not considered among the top three or four Southern writers of the time. Not until Malcolm Cowley's rediscovery of Faulkner in the late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly Styron is still writing. I see him as, he always tried to be the successor to Faulkner in certain ways, and I think he succeeded in certain ways, too. I think there is a undertaking the big subject. What I found happening in a way, though, that is that what had been organic and real with people like Faulkner, people like George Washington Cable in the late 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
That is a true love-hate relationship with the South in many ways. Certainly a writer like Lillian Smith, in particular in the 1930s and 40s, became in the post-Civil Rights Movement era, that is in the late 60s, almost a contrivance in part, habit, a form. Willie Morris in North Toward Home wrote a great book, a really eloquent book. But I think in Morris, the love and hate and shame and pride aren't quite so deeply felt. There isn't quite seriously the threat to life and limb and financial well-being with Morris as there was for the outspoken white or black Southern writer earlier.
Uh-huh. It's a commonplace these days, Fred Hobson, that American youngsters have, if not lost touch completely with their cultural inheritance, that they are largely unaware of it. And yet, here as editor of the Southern Review, you look upon a region which is supposedly, or we are told, profoundly conscious of its inheritance, of its history. Is that a contradiction in the South today, the kind of literature it's producing? Help me to understand that.
I think in many ways there is a lack of regard, a lack of understanding of Southern history and tradition, though one wouldn't find that necessarily in other writers under 35 who are writing now. I don't think writers anymore... one thing I have found as co-editor of the Southern Review is that writers no longer write under the shadow of Faulkner. It is more under the shadow of Welty and O'Connor. These are the short stories I get seem to be inspired far more by O'Connor and Welty than by Faulkner.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether the idea is they're somehow easier to duplicate than Faulkner is,
mm-hmm.
or what.
Fred Hobson, who are the Southern writers active today in the late 1980s that, in your opinion, will remember 50 years, 100 years from now? Can you name some names and some titles?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly Alice Walker, The Color Purple. If Toni Morrison were considered a Southern writer, she's a black writer, obviously, with a great interest in the South,
mm-hmm.
I think she would be one of the truly significant writers of the day. If one includes Styron, and one should, since Styron is still writing, though he began to write in the late 40s, I do see Styron as one of the Southern giants, certainly Walker Percy mm-hmm. as well. Ernest Gaines, the black writer from Louisiana, I find Gaines a powerful writer. And there are other writers who are not, quote, powerful in the same way, whose work has the power of everyday life, of truth-telling.
Who do you have in mind?
Bobby Ann Mason,
mm-hmm.
Writers of that sort, who are sometimes said to write minimalist fiction. But there is the power of everyday small truths in writers such as Mason.
Fred Hobson, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Again, you're the co-editor of the Southern Review. You've been describing writers that we may or may not remember 25, 50, 100 years from now. What about the South itself? Will it, in your opinion, retain its distinctive character? Project yourself forward 50 years and look back and tell us what you see.
Certainly, I think the South will, to an extent, although, to be very honest, less so in time. And now, that is rather unfortunate. I wouldn't have said that in the 60s. I wanted the South to change rather radically in the 50s and 60s. I am certainly glad it did. Now, however, now that the albatross of segregation is gone, at least in a legal sense, the South appears to... to be no more culpable than the rest of the nation in any case. Now that the South isn't distinctive in that way necessarily now, I think it is rather regrettable that Southern distinctiveness is going, though not gone.
Huh.
I think, in a way, Southern distinctiveness now is seen in matters of style, in part. Speech, manners, a certain pose, gestures, things of this sort, as well as certainly John Shelton Reed would say.
This is the sociologist at Chapel Hill.
I would say that Southerners do retain attitudes different from those of non-Southerners, even after they leave the country and come to the city.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably true, a distrust of... institutionalized truth emanating from universities and newspapers and network television, mm-hmm. things of that sort. I think John is partly right. I think, though, in time, 50 years down the road, that won't be the case after the country is even further behind.
Mm-hmm. Quick footnote to our conversation, Fred Hobson. I'll ask you to be modest and immodest at the same time. Do you think that the kind of work that you do at the Southern Review has anything to do in reality with what the South is, with the direction it takes? What is the function of this journal?
I suppose the function of the Southern Review is to produce the best writing, not necessarily about the South alone, although there's always been a great Southern emphasis in the Southern Review. Much of the work in the Southern Review obviously is non-Southern. To not in the practical sense of trying to explain the South, not in the sense of trying to
not public
make
policy.
The South better, right, right. Precisely, but simply to capture the South, I suppose, in certain ways. To produce good writing, first of all. Something that the Southern Review has been doing much more recently is to include both black and white Southerners. Certainly this itself is a statement about the changing South. So the Southern Review doesn't see itself as having a missionary impulse or function, simply to capture the contemporary South and contemporary America through writing that is good.
Fred Hobson recently began teaching at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Before that, he served as co-editor of the Southern Review. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 464. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about colonialism in the American South and in modern India. My guests will be Daniel Littlefield of Louisiana State University and John Sell of Duke University. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The third week in August marks birthdays for Claude Debussy, the French composer, for Bret Hart, the American journalist and novelist, for Edgar Lee Masters, the American poet, for Geraldine Ferraro, the first American woman nominated for the vice presidency, and for Alan Pinkerton, the Scottish-born American detective. Claude Debussy was born during the third week in August, 1862. Bret Hart in 1836, Edgar Lee Masters in 1869, Geraldine Ferraro in 1935, and Alan Pinkerton in 1819. This week marks the anniversary of the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, when the killing of thousands of French Protestants was ordered in August 1572 by King Charles IX. British forces invaded Washington, D.C. in late August 1814. They burned the Capitol, the President's House, and other public buildings. Finally, Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti were executed in Massachusetts during the third week in August 1927. To the end, Sacco and Vanzetti argue their innocence of a factory payroll robbery and murder of a guard. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Rethinking American Literature, this week on Soundings. Annette Kolodny of the University of Arizona and Everett Emerson of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill discuss American writing with particular attention to race, class, and gender. Fred Hobson, until recently co-editor of the Southern Review, talks about contemporary Southern American writing. Rethinking American Literature, this week on Soundings.